That's Segundo here, and while I'm not much of a father, I can certainly understand what being a papa is like. You see, there once was a kid who followed me home. He was 6 years old and insisted that I was his father. I gave him a beer to be polite. I asked him who his mother was, and he mentioned a name that was vaguely familiar to me, and something about an overdue payment. I wasn't sure what he meant, but before I knew it, I was appearing in court, having hired one of those trusted attorneys I saw on late night television when I could not sleep. Except this attorney wasn't so trustworthy as I thought, and we lost the case, even after I had submitted a sperm sample. A prodigious sperm sample, if you catch my drift. I never saw the kid again. There's a lesson in this story. Even call girls get the blues.
So I am here with Neil Pollack, author of the Neil Pollack Anthology of Literature, and most recently a memoir called Alternidad. Neil, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you about this kind of, you've authored a father memoir, and right now there's this considerable flack against any kind of father memoirs, and even also the Steve Allman stuff on Babel. Why do you think there's so much hostility out there?
Oh, I don't know if there's any more hostility than there is to any kind of memoir. You know, I think this is all just part and parcel of the mommy wars, mm-hmm. is that their parenting is a subject that makes people crazy, mm-hmm. and both when they're practicing it and when they're writing about it and when they're reading about it. So I just think that there are so many different styles of parenting and so many different ideas of parenting, and I even hate the word parenting. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a strange verb, or adverb or adjective. How do you say? I think it's an adjective and a verb. Regardless, I don't know. So I'm not exactly sure why there's so much controversy. I think that more than reacting to the fatherhood stuff, I think there's a sort of a reaction to this concept of hip parenting. Mm-hmm. You know, so you'd lump me and Babbel.com and, you know, various other rock and roll parenting memoirs that are coming out. I know of at least three coming out within the next year and a half. So it's just a genre of literature that, you know, is taking some getting used to.
Is this a case, basically, of people not being able to adapt, of essentially the hipsters of the 90s just starting to grow up right now and having kids? Or?
Yeah, I think it's kind of, it's a growing pains situation, to quote a popular parenting sitcom of my youth. I think a lot of the reaction to this is the same kind of reaction the baby boomers got when they came of age. You know, you've got middle and upper middle class, mostly white people sort of, you know, moaning about their aching joints. You know,
you're going to write your next book in second person then, basically.
But probably not. That's just that takes a lot of skill to pull off well. So I think there's a reaction to that, but that literature is inevitable in a way, mm-hmm. and I'm just trying to do it as well as I can.
Well, let's talk about the book. The first 80 pages of this book is devoted to a sort of before section, before Elijah sprang from the womb, as it were.
Yes.
And you paint a portrait of yourself as essentially a guy with street cred. You portray yourself in the early courtship of you and Regina, and your efforts to live in a rundown Philadelphia neighborhood that didn't quite go successfully and the like. You really went out of your way in this section to sort of portray yourself as a really good guy, more so, I think, than anything I've ever seen in your other writing. And I'm wondering why the sort of Pollack stuffing here was this kind of to counteract the Pollack persona stuffing of the past?
I think to some extent, yeah. But I also think that this was, it's a fairly accurate rendering of who I actually was. Then, you know, it's necessary to set up the rest of the book. I'm not my persona. You know, I occasionally, you know, in time, especially during the rock and roll years, I kind of got carried away with it a little bit in public. But in the end, you know, when the day was over, that I think I'm good at the core. And I don't know, that just, it, so the book, if that's the way I appear in the book, it's not deliberate. I just tried to describe myself as accurately as I could.
Well, when you say you're not the persona, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm not entirely arrogant. I mean, I have an ego, but I'm certainly not this like rampaging ego that I write on the page. My books are a satire. My early books are a satire of, you know, literary ego and literary persona. And, you know, the I'm just a guy who sits around watching ESPN in his underwear.
Yeah.
You know, and so that may not be a sort of a as glamorous a portrayal, or maybe even not as interesting a one, but it's the truth. And since I'm writing a writing a memoir, I figured I might as well tell the truth.
Okay. Well, one aspect, actually, I should point out of alternative that I had observed in the book that a lot of reviewers didn't observe is your role as a neighborhood activist in Austin.
Yes.
And this kind of goes with my previous question of, like, portraying yourself as a good guy. But I wanted to actually ask you, what relationship does this activism have to fatherhood? I mean, aside from the obvious, you know, relationship of, like, looking out for kids in the neighborhood and things like that.
Well, I think with fatherhood comes an increased sense of responsibility. And if you're living in an area that requires help and no one is rising to the occasion, I think that, you know, when you become a dad, you feel that that increased, you know, sense, like I said, sense of responsibility. So that it naturally translates to activism of some sort. A lot of politicians get their start doing simple stuff like I did. I'm not going to be a politician, and I abandoned that work fairly quickly because it was obvious that it wasn't going anywhere. And that I was also going to be leaving town. But the guy who bought my house for me in Austin actually now has taken my former position. So it's like that corner has some kind of totemic political power, I guess. You know, where I live now in L.A., it's you know, it's a mildly gentrifying middle class Mexican neighborhood with some, you know, moderate yuppies and some Korean families thrown in. And it just doesn't require the same amount of, you know, constant involvement with city officials. It's fairly well taken care of.
But simultaneously, I think, though, from the very beginnings of your career, I have read some of your journalism in the past before the Neil Pollack persona even came to be, and there was certainly a concern on your part for class and ethnicity and things like that, and it sort of resurfaced with this period as a Boston activist.
Yeah, I've always been interested in issues of class and race and ethnicity. I haven't really written about it in any extent in my books. Well, I'm a little bit in Alternidad, but I definitely think about that stuff a lot. And it was at the forefront of my life when I lived in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then it kind of faded to the background during the ultra-white McSweeney's years.
Yeah.
And now, you know, and then it had a little bit of a resurgence in Texas, and now living in L.A., you know, just a polyglot metropolis, it's inevitably also comes up all the time.
Do you still sort of, I guess, concentrate or dwell upon this in L.A.? I mean, there's all sorts of neighborhoods down there. There's all sorts of
multicultural
fusion there.
I love it. You know, I love not knowing who's going to be behind the door when you open it. You know, and one thing I really love doing in L.A. is going to the Commerce Casino. Mm-hmm. It's a 24-hour poker room. It's the biggest one in the world. And the diaspora of desperation just really appeals to me. You know, just people from six continents losing money.
Well, this seems a little bit different from the description you just gave of yourself of a guy who sits around in his underwear watching ESPN.
Well, I do a lot of that, but I also, you know, yes, I go to poker rooms and I, you know, sometimes I go hear music and I like to go out to dinner. I mean, I'm not really a homebody, but, you know, I'm just basically a normal guy with some hobbies.
Okay. Well, I wanted to actually, speaking of this normal guy, there was an interview you gave with Tom Lynch of New City Chicago in which you offered a very honest and laudable answer, because most writers don't confess this, but you were asked why you wrote the book and you responded, "I needed a new book contract in order to feed my family." Now, given this realism, this sort of reality, putting food on the table, obviously there might have been some sort of tinge of commercialism in writing Alternidad. How did you balance the art of writing with the commercialism of turning this thing out?
Well, I knew from the beginning that this was a commercially viable idea for a book. I mean, there are a couple of publishers who bid on it. These days, publishers rarely take a chance on something because it's artistically brilliant. Even the artistically brilliant books have some sort of commercial, you know, like, you know, the 900-page novel that just came out, they're calling The Indian Godfather.
Yeah, Vikram Chandra. Yeah,
yeah, very, very literary book, but it's, you know, it's The Indian Godfather. You know, it's very commercial. So I think that, you know, this is the publishing industry, even at the most indie levels, is about commerce because people are trying to get paid to write for a living. Mm-hmm. And I think that for writers to say that they don't think about business is disingenuous, because a successful writer is a successful business person. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're able to get paid doing what you want to do, then you're in business doing that. I don't see the two, art and commerce, as being inseparable necessarily.
But some people do. Like, I mean, David Marks and Gilbert Sorrentino never made really much of a dime off of their works, you know?
That's true, but they also wrote extremely avant-garde fiction that, you know, wasn't going to find a mass audience, you know? It's like, I mean, do you think they deliberately took an anti-commercial stance?
No, that's just their the way they express themselves.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are, you know, I'm not saying that the commercially viable works are the only well-written works, or even that they're better written than non-commercially viable works, because that's definitely not the case. But my writing style has always been reasonably accessible. You know, I'm not an avant-garde stylist for the most part.
Yeah.
I like avant-garde writers, and I read them, and, you know, it certainly pushes the bar up for me. But I think, you know, I'm destined to write more sort of widely palatable stuff.
But some of your essays in the past and some of your stunts in the past, I remember reading some interview with you where you had ripped To Kill a Mockingbird in front of a crowd, and it had gotten really considerable reaction from people.
Well,
there's a certain kind of shock component, I suppose,
you know,
that is maybe not so much accessible, or maybe perhaps it is.
When I lived in Chicago, I had a lot of theater training. Mm-hmm. I studied with the Neo-Futurists to do a show called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. It's, you know, 30, 60-second plays. I did a lot of improv. I went to a lot of plays by this avant-garde troupe called Theater Oobleck.
Yes.
You're familiar with them.
Yeah, I've done San Francisco Fringe work, actually. So yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I spent a lot of time going to Fringe Theater. Richard Foreman, I've seen a lot of Richard Foreman plays. You know, so, and I've read a lot of avant-garde theater, so I'm familiar with, you know, that it's Marinetti, right? It's the Marinetti School, that theater of
I think so, yeah.
You know, and I'm familiar with that and with Theater of the Absurd and all that. So, you know, I was able to practice it a little bit during my more stunty days. Even now on this tour, I mean, I'm occasionally, like, doing shows where there are kids involved.
Yeah.
You know, we had a dance party here in San Francisco where it was this dance troupe called the Devilettes, who are extremely sexy women, and some of them are moms, and they do something called Pipsqueak a Go-Go, where they teach kids how to dance go-go style. And there was a band of dads, not as sexy, called the Timeouts, and they played songs, and I did a little reading, and, you know, it had a slightly absurdist feel to it, and so I mean, I have some theatrical training, not a lot, and which was maybe why the stagings are some kind. I kind of just go into situations and stage something on the spot, and
gotcha.
It's always been part of my life.
Going back to this notion of, like, I guess, artistic versus commercial, would you say, though, I guess, you mentioned earlier just these stunty days.
Yeah.
So you in the past tense.
Well, I basically, every book has its own public appearances. It has its own style of public appearances. With the anthology, I was doing sort of, you know, pompous public literary presentations, as well as occasional stunty stuff just to call attention to myself.
Yeah.
With the rock and roll band, I was, for the rock and roll book, I formed a punk rock band and went on tour with it with very, very mixed results. And for this book, I'm doing some straight readings, then sort of a lot of family-related parties, you know, afternoon things with music for kids and whatnot, because that's what the book calls for.
Family stunty, then, basically.
Family stunty. And a little, you know, and more sort of widely available in some ways. Not confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of family-friendly performance art. Yeah, so, if I were to write a book about sports, it would have a, you know, there'd be some, I'd come up with some sort of way to do that appropriately, and every book's going to have its own set of public rules, in a way.
I wanted to actually get your thoughts on this. I'm not sure if you're familiar with a piece that was written by Merritt Ingram relating to alternative.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, he or she?
Merritt, I think it's a she.
It's a she.
Yes.
She basically suggested that, you know, a lot of other people have tackled the subject of subcultural parenting before. She evoked Spike Gillespie, Alison Krauss, Rosemarie DeDonato, and she sort of suggested that you weren't necessarily the first person to struggle with this loss of self-identity, and that, you know, this isn't exactly a new topic. So what makes Alternidad different?
Well,
from
it's certainly true that I'm not. I think parents throughout the generations have struggled with this. I mean, my parents certainly did, and their parents did, and, you know, as long as there's sort of been a middle class that was able to struggle with questions of identity, that had the time to do it, I think this has been a topic. And it is true that in the late 80s and early 90s and mid 90s, there were a lot of sort of female zine writers who were having kids who were writing about this. That doesn't mean it's not a viable topic for now. And I think the two things that differentiate what I'm doing from what they did, which is not to discredit what they did, certainly, but is that I'm a dad doing it, and it's just sort of the dads are just sort of starting to come to that awareness because the role of fatherhood is changing. And the other thing slipped my mind. I think that the fact that the changing role of fatherhood is the real motivator here.
The changing. By what do
well,
you mean
well,
by that?
For instance, like when my wife was done breastfeeding, basically she and I were 50-50 with the kid.
Yeah,
and that's just new for men for the most part. You know, this isn't the whole idea of Mr. Mom is gone. Mm-hmm. You know, that's no longer really where the comedy is. But you know, I did think of the other thing. It's that hip parenting, this sort of this subculture, increasingly more mainstream culture of you know, rock and roll onesies and yeah. You know, and you know, sippy cup shows here in San Francisco that play to 800 people. Yeah. And you know, Dan Zane selling out concert halls. I mean, it's that to me is a field that is just ripe. Mm-hmm. You know, I did an entry on my blog about a pizzeria in Austin that had a kids can you draw Morrissey contest. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and there were hundreds of drawings of Morrissey up on the wall. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
So I think there's that as well. And, you know, writers who did it before can criticize me all they want. But I think that it's really, you know, when it comes to parents and parent writing, I really think that all boats should rise together. I don't know. I'm not saying an absence of snark is good. That's not my bag. But, yeah. You know, I think that I've always found the mommy wars a bit absurd. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, this is just an extension of the mommy wars.
But it could also be argued that all of these sort of pictures of Morrissey up on the wall represent not necessarily an alternative, but almost a kind of new conformity. There was a Canadian culture critic named Hal Niedzwiecki, mm-hmm. who wrote this interesting book called Hello, I'm Special, laden with generalizations, but he did have a particular point about the fact that we drift towards this notion of special, and it becomes, as a result, this sort of new conformity. So how, given
I'm not going to argue with that at all. I think that's a major theme of my writing. I'm under no, you know, the Alternadad title is meant to be highly ironic. Believe it or not, that's mm-hmm. something I do is going to be highly ironic because, you know, the notion of alternative culture was so heavily marketed to us when we were in our actual youth as opposed to our, you know, the senescence of our youth that we're going through right now. And, you know, but it was never alternative. It was always just sort of a mass marketed mainstream counterculture. You know, it was a commodification of cool, I think Tom Frank called it.
Yeah.
And I think that this hip parenting is exactly the same phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The fact that I chose to describe it narratively rather than describe it as a sociologist would, that was just an aesthetic choice I made.
Yeah.
It's a more fun book to write, but I'm under no illusion that what I'm doing is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think this new conformity, I still think it's a better kind of conformity than the 80s and 90s Uber parenting, Barney humping, you know, Gymboree class, mommy and me class going, you know, soccer mom culture. I think it's what we're doing now is, you know, much better.
But at the same time, like a soccer mom, it is still sort of laden with streaks of conformity to some degree.
That's true. But you know what? You got to take care of your kids.
Yeah.
And so it's laden with streaks of conformity. I mean, kids like routine, mm-hmm. and you might as well give them a routine that's fun for you. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to be a conformist or a nonconformist. I'm just trying to, you know, raise a happy family in an environment that I'm comfortable in.
But getting Elijah to like really groove to the Hives, that strikes me as
I liked the Hives album and I played it for my kid and he enjoyed it. So what? Mm. Big freaking deal.
But doesn't this kind of sort of like go against the whole message of, hey parents, you can sort of embrace this notion of getting clued into culture, getting hooked up, or
I don't know. I mean, it's what parents do now. They pop the iPod on and they play songs that they like for their kids.
Yeah.
I don't know what I don't know if that sends a message at all, but God knows I've heard from lots of dads and moms who do the same thing. So it may be conformity, but I don't know. It's still pretty fun.
Okay. So then in that case, then, I mean, though, that this goes kind of against this sort of history of essentially kind of rocking the boat a little bit. Does Alternadad rock the boat in any way, would you say?
I don't know.
You don't know. I don't know the book.
I don't know if it rocks the boat. I don't even know what the frickin' boat is.
Oh.
You know, I think that, you know, people are getting angry about it. You know, it's certainly getting battered.
Lisa Carter's on your ass.
Yeah, Lisa Carver.
Carver, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, what's weird, I think it is, where it might be rocking the boat is that the sort of left of parenting, you know, sort of the sort of Riot Girl, Zinester crowd, those are the ones who are doing the most of the attacking here. It's not... You know, I got an email from a reverend in Boston who was using my book in his sermon as an example of positive parenting. Mm. I was like, oh my, what the hell? You know, I mean, I'm high throughout most of the book, as I am throughout most of my life. Yeah. And, you know, but he's using it. And I think, you know, that's okay with me. I don't care who my audience is. You know, if I'm pissing off the Zinester crowd, then that's rocking their boat.
They're coming to arrest you right now, as a matter of fact.
They are. They do that all the time. But really, they just have a siren. They don't actually have a car.
They don't even have officers.
But. Yeah, so I think, you know, so I'm not getting really, I'm not getting hit from the right here. I'm getting hit from the left, and if I'm getting hit at all. And I think that's very interesting, but that means that I'm rocking some boat, because if people are annoyed by this, you know, then I must be saying something either controversial or annoying. But no, I'm not trying to revolutionize anything with this book. I just tried to tell a simple, straightforward story, you know, about being a dad.
Well, with this sort of misperception, perhaps, in mind, I wanted to bring up what you bring up near the end of the book, which is Elijah's biting incident and the essay that you wrote for Salon.
Yeah.
And the considerably hostile reactions you got.
Yeah, yeah.
You really sort of present in this book this, you know, you and Regina are horrified by a lot of this sort of misperception, yet you also sort of note that this essay was written in haste. And I know you've said before in other interviews that you have a thick skin, but it seems to me that you still took this criticism to heart.
Well, the reason the essay was written in haste is because it was tied in with something that was happening in the culture right then. There was a study that had come out that talked about kids getting expelled from preschool at a higher rate. So I kind of tied my personal experience in with that. If I'd had a month or so to reflect on the situation, it might not, the essay might not have sounded so whiny.
Yeah,
you know, when in presented in the book, it's a little bit. I measure it a lot. I tried to measure it and ponder on stuff a little bit more. So the reaction was strong, but you know, that's parenting for you. I mean, you write about parenting, and things are going to explode. Things exploded on Salon when they published the chapter on circumcision.
Yeah,
you know, that's just the way it is when you write about parenting. It's the mommy wars. And you know, I was stunned and hurt when it happened the first time, but I'm no longer stunned and hurt, you know? I'm just like, all right.
Yeah, but that wasn't that long ago, however.
It was a year and a half ago now, enough time to process it for sure, you know? And it was May of 2005, so it was, you know, getting close to 2 years now.
Yeah.
You know, and each subsequent time, either I'll write something in response or I'll just let it go.
So you really don't care what people think?
I can't, you know.
And yet
I'm just glad they're talking.
Yeah.
You know. I don't care what people think. I can't.
But you just mentioned that you were hurt at the time.
At the time, I was. Well, sure. You know, anytime like sort of a fresh strain of vitriol, a new virus, so to speak, enters, it's always kind of hard to deal with. But you know. But now I'm used to it, and God knows I'm used to being attacked vitriolically. It's been happening to me for almost a decade now. consistently, and you know, at a certain point you just say, all right, I'm still pissing them off. I must be doing something right.
So for you, your MO is largely to provoke, essentially.
It's not my only MO. I also want to entertain, and I want to, you know, really, you know, I think I'm a comedy writer more than anything else.
Yeah.
And so I want to make people laugh, and I don't really even, I just want to entertain. Provocation is just something that comes naturally to me. I've been pissing people off consistently for, you know, 25 years.
Yeah. Well, there is one essay I also wanted to ask you about, and specifically I wanted to ask if it was written in haste, and that was the infamous February 2003 essay in The Stranger, which I'll read in part. Shut up, anti-war people. Shut up, pro-war people. Shut down your computers and shut your goddamn pie holes. No one gives a shit what you write, so stop writing about the war. Shut up, all of you. Was this written in haste? Or?
No, it was written out of I mean, first of all, I was writing about the war too. No, I was a anti-war blogger who I'd been mocking the Bush administration, satirically mocking them for, you know, a while on the blog. But I was just, you know, at the time I was just the fever pitch of commentary was so high. It was just driving me crazy. You know, as we now know, nothing anybody says on either side is going to stop these morons. So.
But at the same time, 4 years later, there are far more deaths. It's clearly a disaster.
Said I wasn't against the war, but I don't think, you know.
Isn't that a bit of an oxymoron? This notion of like complaining about commentary while also participating in it yourself?
No, it was just no. I don't think so. I was annoyed by the...
So you're one of the kind of, like, great sort of chosen ones to comment upon the war.
Well, yeah, okay. So maybe there was a little hypocrisy. So what? Yeah. You know, I was at the time, I was sick of it, you know? Because, I mean, if you don't remember, maybe you remember, like, the 2 years after 9/11 was just, like, the writing was just so awful.
Yeah.
You know, the fiction, attempts to memorialize it in fiction were terrible, and really still are terrible for the most part. And, you know, the nonfiction writing. You know,
about that, because I'm not sure if you read any of the National Book Award nominees, but four of them dealt with September 11th, and I found them all to be quite...
It's getting better and better.
Yeah.
I agree. You know, and I read The Zero by Jess Walter, which I thought...
That's the only one I didn't read. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah. When did the National Book Award nominations come out?
Well, they awarded it to Richard Powers.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I was thinking of the Book Critics Circle. I read that. That's the only one I've read then. And I thought it was very thoughtful and interesting. But
maybe people needed to sort of, you know, gestate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Exactly. I think that's the point. And, you know, I wouldn't say that about commentary now. I think people have much greater perspective about what's going on. I don't know. I just was annoyed at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
But then some people could also turn around to you and say, "You, Sir Neil Pollack, shut up."
They did.
There are too many.
They
did.
And I was like, "All right, I'll shut up."
Well, we're talking right now, though. Shut up about parenting is what I'm sort of suggesting.
So,
a lot of people have been sort of criticizing this book. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I think that people are sort of saying
some people. There's been positive and negative criticism. This has definitely been the best reviewed book I've written. So, I mean. What were you going to posit?
The question is the nature of commentary, even in a crude form, does it have any kind of sort of value? I mean, you know, it seems to me that the shut up essay was more of a visceral reaction, but at the same time,
so
a lot of people really just were upset by it.
Yeah, and a lot of people also really liked it. That's the thing, is I've always had this uncanny ability to, you know, I've always had this sort of love me or hate me kind of thing going on, especially with my writing.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, like, yeah, people were upset by it, but I also, you know, I also had a lot of people telling me they appreciated it.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the parent with this book. For some reason, even though it's a pretty simple book, you know, about a pretty basic subject, it's been getting harsh reaction and then a lot of praise too. So, so again, it's just a sign that I'm doing something right.
What specifically is a sign? Just the reaction?
Yeah, I mean, if people are reacting to what I'm writing, as opposed to just kind of, you know, blowing it off, it's a sign that it's affecting them in some way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even if it's making them completely furious.
So as a writer, basically, you're sort of suggesting here that reaction is kind of like one of the main motivating forces here. How crazy can you actually write something?
No, I honestly don't try to provoke it. I really don't try to provoke anything. I'm always surprised when the reaction goes kablooey.
Telling people to shut up is
That one was an exception. Okay, that one was a particular one, and it was also, you know, the editors at the paper were kind of egging me on that the Stranger likes to publish stuff like that, and they're a really fun newspaper, but they like to publish stuff that's going to make people crazy, and they've always been encouraged that side of me, and which is nice because then I have a home for that kind of piece when I decide to write it. But the anthology of American literature was, you know, in some ways. Which actually I think has received the least amount of criticism of anything, negative criticism. Everything I've done was just sort of a, you know, light jabs at, you know, literary culture. And then, you know, never mind the Pollocks was, you know, a little more obnoxious maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't set out to write anything with the exception of the occasional magazine or newspaper piece with the intention to provoke.
Okay. Well, then I guess the question is how this nature of provoking, you really feel that it's evident in sort of, I guess, adopting the mainstream and alternative that by your own confession, or adopting this fun, albeit fun, sort of conformity?
So what are you trying to, I don't quite get that
the
one.
The suggestion here is that you get this level of provocation that you enjoy through Alternidad, through sort of embracing the kind of conformist sort of fun.
See, the thing is, I didn't really, at the time when I was writing the book, I wasn't reading any other parenting writing. I wasn't reading blogs. I was living in kind of a bubble.
Yeah.
And I had very little idea that this was part of a larger cultural trend.
Yeah.
You know, I was just living my life, and I was describing my life as I was living it. Only after the book was done did I start realizing that this was actually the norm instead of the exception.
But yeah, with Nevermind the Pollocks, you just submerged yourself in CDs for that one. Why didn't you just investigate a lot of other parenting books?
Because this was a personal story, and I didn't want to be affected by other voices and think that anything was off limits or overdone, you know? Nevermind the Pollocks is like there had never been a satirical novel written about rock critics, you know? So I was like, I knew that would, so I just immersed myself in the literature and rock and roll, and also in the music. And with the anthology, again, there was nothing that had existed like it before, whereas I was perfectly aware that there were a bazillion mommy and daddy memoirs. I just... the only thing I did was watch parenting movies.
Okay. Like, what did you see?
Mr. Mom, Parenthood, She's Having a Baby, Look Who's Talking, Daddy Daycare. I mean, good movies, bad movies, Father of the Bride, the Steve Martin one, and the original Spencer Tracy one. You know,
movies that presented
Meet
parents
Me in St. Louis. I watch that every
That's
year.
That's a great
anyway.
Movie.
I watch that every year anyway because I'm, you know.
Vincent Minnelli fan?
Yeah, I have certain proclivities toward Broadway.
what do you mean by that? You can't.
I just like musicals, okay?
Okay.
You know, I can relate to all that jazz. What can I say?
You're among friends. I'm also the same way.
I
live in San Francisco, but I don't swing quite that way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not about sexual preference. It's just about fact. Anyway, but what were we talking about before that?
Well, we were talking about the movies and.
Oh yeah, so I watched those just to, you know, kind of get a sense of what, you know, how parenting had been portrayed in the past. I read some older stuff. I read Act One by Moss Hart, which is a Broadway memoir, but it's also a wonderful story about a family, sort of immigrant family. I read Gene Shepard. I didn't read the old Bill Cosby and Paul Reiser books because those are sort of more joke books than literature. I even like reread some old John Cheever stories.
Really?
Well, you know, he wrote about parenting in a way. That was one of his concerns. I mean, you know, it's an eternal theme in a way. There's even stuff about it in Anna Karenina, you know, I mean, it's there. It's always there. So believe me, Alternidad is no Anna Karenina, but to say the least. But, you know, I didn't feel like reading any contemporary literature. So especially not blogs.
Yeah.
So what was the time? Now I do.
This kind of reading submersal, what was the point of this? Just to kind of get a sort of mean tone before writing, or
what you mean for Nevermind the Pollocks?
No. I'm talking about.
Oh,
the
I just
and
you
by
know,
mean I mean I, average. Yeah,
I just wanted to get a sense of my subject matter. Mm-hmm. You know, just doing some research, which I think a lot of writers do for their books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just okay. Figure out what the freak, you know, just look, searching for a tone, seeing, you know, what sort of absolutes were in all the movies, and then what, you know, I could bring, what details I could bring specifically to the table.
Yeah. But the one thing that's really interestingly in common with all of these films is that they present these really sort of positive portrayals of parenthood.
Yes,
so was this kind of an issue? You were just trying to tap into some positivism here? Or?
No, I have a positive attitude toward parenting. I can't freaking help it. Mm-hmm. It's the one thing I can't get. I mean, I can get a little cranky about certain aspects of the culture, but you know,
yeah.
I have a happy family, so sue me.
You're sued now. I wanted to actually ask you about the pot vaporizer in this book, which is also known as the Silver Surfer.
Yes.
This was a present that you had actually purchased yourself.
Yes. No one else was going to get
it for
me.
For your 35th birthday. But since this was you apparently paid some sort of astronomical sum for this.
It wasn't astronomical. It was, you know.
Well, in any event, I wanted to know whether this really represents alternative or whether this was more of a kind of...
No, I'm just a stoner.
Okay. Then why include this chapter in the umbrella of...
Well, I do think that the stoner dad had not been portrayed much. You know, I'm not saying it's an avant-garde position or an avant-garde way to be, but it was sort of a new portrayal, and also it's who I am and who I was, and you know, and me being Stone plays into some of the scenes in the book, not the scenes involving my son, but you know, it plays into the narrative. So it's not as though I just included it for no reason.
Was the book a way for you to sort of, I guess, come to terms with this? You know, there was, of course, the famous David Camp review of Nevermind the Pollocks,
where
there was
kidding.
Real Neil versus surreal Neil.
Yeah.
And was this sort of presentation of yourself as a kind of self-deprecatory, real kind of figure a way for you to, were you just really kind of try to write without any kind of...
I think that it was about time for something like this. I think that if I'd continued along the Nevermind the Pollocks path, things would have gone very badly for me, and they would have gotten very tired very quickly. At the time, I didn't have any good ideas in that. Yeah. The best idea I had was for Alternidad, so that's what I went with, mm-hmm. You know?
What do you mean it would get tiresome for you? Well, I mean, personas develop over time.
Yeah, well, sure, of course. And some could say that this Alternidad is the next stage, you know, and a persona, even though it's a very as genuine as I can make myself, you know, and to the public. But I don't know. I was just tired of pretending to be someone who I wasn't.
But at the same time, when you go ahead, and I know this because I'm, you know, a satirical writer, although, you know, I don't have books out yet. Yeah. But when you actually sit down and write something that is satirical, it is still nevertheless a part of you when you feed into something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think part of the problem was that I was doing it eponymously. Mm-hmm. And because of that, my identity became confused both to myself and to other people. You know, if I'd written Nevermind the Pollocks and the main character hadn't been named Neil Pollock, or if the first book had been named something else, it would have been an entirely different set of circumstances. If I had to do it again, I would have named it the Jordan Kincaid Anthology of American Literature by Neil Pollack, or with assistance edited by Neil Pollack or whatever. And that way it would have been able to, if I'd gone out in public, I could have pretended to be a character.
But you also, it seems to me that this was a theatrical presence based off of your theatrical.
Yeah, but I could have done it too. A different way. You know, I could have done it a different way, and I could have done the punk rock thing a different way. I didn't have to name the character after me. It was, it's what happened. I don't regret it, but, you know.
But you did it multiple times over multiple projects.
Exactly. And if I had to do it again, I would probably give the guys from those projects different names, because they were different characters, and it could have been known that I was writing them. I think if I'm going to do that kind of character again in the future, I'm going to give him a different name, mm-hmm. and just, you know, let it be known that I'm writing satire, not writing about how awesome I am.
When you were concocting these various Neil Pollock personas, why did you sort of return to it? Did you feel at the time a sense of like, oh, I'm doing this again, I don't want to do this, or what?
Only toward the end of the sort of Nevermind the Pollocks, the Nevermind the Pollocks experience, it got very old and very tired, mm-hmm. and I felt very old and very tired. Yeah. You know, it was fun for a while.
Yeah.
It was really fun through about 2002, and then I had some sort of lean middle years there, and it just was not fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you could have always just taken it off for a rest and possibly return.
No, I couldn't have, because I needed to continue to earn money, and I had no other means. And then this was it. I determined that I was going to make a living as a writer of books, and you know, take it as far as I could.
I wanted to ask you, and you don't have to comment upon this if you don't feel like it, but I wanted to actually ask you about the situation between you and Dave Eggers.
I'll talk about it to some extent.
I mean, to me, here's a guy who gave you the flagship title of his print, McSweeney's, and then proceeded to essentially kind of like, you know, oh, you're too dark for me, only a matter of a few years later. And that to me strikes, I mean, you know, if that had happened to me, I mean, not even a chance of like, hey, I could write something along the lines of Alternidad, just a sort of like closed sort of shoulders. Did this kind of maybe factor into what you were feeling like around 2002, somewhere around there?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a bad breakup. You know, I mean, there's no question about it, and it was hard to, you know, essentially be told that I was no longer an invited guest to the party, to the literary party. You know, for a while, I'd been in the center of this, you know, really like lively movement of, you know, hot young writers, and it was fun, and it was interesting, and I'd always wanted that, and then all of a sudden I was no longer welcome at the table, and you know, it was definitely difficult for me to deal with, and but I've also, you know, I've come to realize, but I've still retained lots of friends from that period as well. It's not as though, like, you know, every door had closed, but I was like, you know, I was definitely like not part of that. I was not on that team anymore.
I haven't seen your name on any 86 literary lists in San Francisco.
No, I have. No, of course not. Yeah. Of course not, because nobody cares that much about writers. You know, and I have done a couple of things with A26 Valencia here and there, but that all completely closed off after the thing I wrote in the New York Times Book Review, which really was just sort of an innocent, you know, little essay about giving up my persona. Yeah. But then it turned into a big hoo-ha with Eggers, and you know, I don't know, it was weird. And you know, what can I say?
Do you have any real sort of ideas on why your essays sometimes become these larger-than-life spats that live beyond the essays? Because very few writers have that. Some writers are just like, their essay is there, and that's it, and no one comments upon it. But in your case, it's like, it seems almost that every sort of remotely confessional thing you do turns into some sort of extreme contretemps of some sort.
What can I say? It's a gift.
Gotcha. After 10 years of this, you surely might have some ideas as to why this is.
No, I really don't. You know, I just, I have this way of, you know, pissing people off. But also, you know, again, I also have friends too. I've made a lot of friends doing this, and you know, and a few enemies. And, you know, I would rather it be going that way than have nobody paying attention at all. So. So I honestly don't know what it is about my writing that sets people's hair on fire.
Yeah, I wanted to actually ask you about Cracked Magazine. And are you still involved with them?
I've done a little bit of writing for them. I mean, I still like contribute to some of their magazine parodies and whatnot.
Because you don't really get a byline in that. What have you done for them exactly?
I contribute to their magazine parodies anonymously.
Okay,
I did a lot of work sort of at the onset of the magazine, recruiting writers and trying to like drum up, you know, business for them, you know. But I mean they were very nice to me, and they, you know, I do like the guys who run it a lot, but they weren't really using the people I was getting for them, and it just didn't, that end of things wasn't working out. But I just started like contributing pieces here and there.
Had you contributed anything really anonymously like this before?
Not really.
But it seems like the reverse of the Neil Pollack persona almost.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm able to write, you know, satire without having, and get paid for it, without having to deal with the, you know, the burden of the persona, which is fun, because I like writing satire.
But a lot of your New York Times Magazine pieces are very much in the alternative ad vein. Some of them are excerpts and stuff like that. I mean,
what I'm writing right now. You know, right now I'm doing dad writing. I'm a parenthood writer, and I will go along that way until I get tired of it, or until it's no longer profitable, or both, you know. And hopefully it'll do well enough so that I can do that and also do whatever I want. You know, that's really the goal, is to be able to do whatever you want to do as a writer without having to worry about money. I mean, you know, it's a dream of every writer, really.
Sure.
So if alternate ad can be a vehicle toward that, then, you know, I'd be thrilled. And I will also, you know, continue to try to do that kind of dad writing as well as I can. And I personally think that my writing, because, you know, since Alternative, I finished the book, has it actually gotten better even. Like, I've figured out what my subject matter is even more. And plus, my kid is older, and he's, you know, and he just says more interesting things. And so he's more of a character himself. So it just makes the writing that much easier.
One thing we haven't actually mentioned as a so-called character is Regina, your wife,
who's
been called also sort of a straight man in a lot of the reviews.
Yeah, I tried to keep her as much in the background as possible, because the book's really not about her. She's a straight man. I mean, Elijah and I are these crazy, hysterical Jews, basically, and she's like a straight-laced Protestant, you know, who has to just deal with our outbursts.
But you have a chapter in this book that is a rather sort of honest and brazenly honest thing about the whole postpartum sex depression thing.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, I'm not saying that I gloss over, you know, everything about her, but, you know, I definitely I don't know. I just don't really have, at the moment, don't see why writing about her in depth would really, it just wouldn't work for me. And I don't think she wants it either.
Yeah.
I think, you know, right now I'm mostly writing about my kid and me. And Regina is not a secondary character in my life, but in the work, she's a supporting player by choice.
That must have been a really difficult thing for you to do, to switch gears from this sort of inventive persona to, like, now I have to sort of write about myself for money. That's, you know.
No, you know what? It happened gradually, and because of that, it felt natural. You know, initially when I was starting to write the book, you know, it was very painful. It was artistically painful. It was difficult for me to find the voice that worked. I wasn't exactly sure what I was trying to say. And then it all kind of kicked into gear with when the episode that I recount in the prologue of the book, the shit-throwing episode. Am I allowed to say shit on internet radio?
You can say whatever you want.
When that occurred, all of a sudden, a lot of things fell into place, and I think I found my voice there. So, you know, it's been a gradual, it's been an evolution.
Do you have, now, this will be my last question, but do you have any sort of overarching idea of what you're going to do next?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Okay.
I would like to write a sequel to Alternadad.
So you're in dad writing mode.
Yeah, I would like to write at least one more book. I think there's another entertaining book in me on that topic. And then after that, I don't know. But I also have been writing short stories and publishing them in various crime fiction anthologies over the last few years and other magazines as well. And I would like to collect those. I think every writer wants to have a short story collection.
Sure.
I've got enough now that I think I could actually put one together. Mm-hmm. And I also have a couple of ideas for novels about sports that I would like to put into play as soon as I can do that without worrying about money. Because but right now I think I'm gonna stick with the dad stuff because it's working and I'm enjoying it, and you know it's funny, you know, my kid is funny, and
but you are diversifying your portfolio.
Well,
right
I'm
now,
not gonna
like.
I'm not I will not, not, not I will I will basket, not be yeah. quote unquote Alternadad for the rest of my life. Yeah. I refuse to be pigeonholed, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, this is fun for now, and it'll probably be fun for a second book, and who knows? Maybe it'd be fun for a third book too. But I'm gonna do other stuff. I'm gonna continue to move around in my mind.
Well, Neil, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you
my
so
pleasure.
Much.
Great
Thanks.
Show. Thank you.
Beautiful girl, lovely dress, high school smiles, oh yes. Beautiful.